they can be there. They can, you know, you can be in these places and see them quite openly walking around in camo gear with AK-47s and grenade launchers, that kind of thing. Then the military can go in there, and these guys can disappear. So they're not controlling a territory to the point they're, you know, sometimes stopping the military going. The military can go in there, then the guys can just disappear into the hills, disappear into houses. Then the military goes away, and they come back out again.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking hot air.
I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, it could change. The people are the ones that can make the change.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Change Agents Season 2. Today, I'm going to be talking to Yoann Griot. Our topic is crime, drugs, police, and gangster politics in Mexico. Yoann is a British journalist, a writer, a producer, and a podcast host, and he is based in Mexico City. He's been covering the drug cartels in Latin America since 2001 for news outlets such as The New York Times, France 24, National Geographic, Time Magazine, Esquire, CNN, Reuters, The Associated Press, and many more. Yoann is the author of three books: Blood, Gun, Money, How America Arms Gangs and Cartels, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and New Politics in Latin America, and El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Here are some pretty shocking stats about crime, drugs, and narco politics in Mexico currently. According to Mexico's National Institute of Statistics and Geography, there were over 32,000 homicides in 2022. And according to the SESNSP, there were 30,973 murders in Mexico the same year, putting the homicide rate at 25 per 100,000 people in 2022. According to the Global Economy, in 2017, the average homicide rate for countries in Latin America was 19.5 per 100,000 people. For reference, for those of you living in the United States, the U.S. averages a homicide rate of 4 to 7 per 100,000 people. Mexican drug cartels are the leading suppliers of cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, and other illicit drugs for the U.S. Drug cartels also have immense wealth that gives them the ability to pay off and influence political officials on a local and national scale. Let's get into it with Yoann. Do you ever worry about your safety, given what's happened to journalists where you're living?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, doing this work, I mean, I will say, like, of the 150 plus journalists who have been murdered in Mexico, the vast majority have been from here, from Mexico, from often the small towns or the cities where the drug cartels are strongest and where they're very, very vulnerable, where they're there in these places and the drug cartel guys will see them around. But that doesn't mean I'm at all immune. There was an American journalist called Philip True who was murdered. There was an American journalist called Bradley Roland Will who was killed in crossfire. There's various American citizens who aren't even journalists, but are just hanging around doing a lot of what I do in terms of going to these same places and going to these towns and have been accused and been murdered. There was one school teacher who was down hanging around with some of these cartel guys in Chihuahua, and they accused him of being a DEA agent and murdered him. I've had the accusation thrown at me as well. So absolutely, I'd be foolish not to be concerned. It's tough. It's a challenging thing to cover. But it's the same like a lot of jobs, firemen, military, a lot of these jobs, you kind of go in there and you have to kind of go in with a mentality if you understand the risks.
Yeah.
And you're going to go in and get the job done.
So given that you've been largely reporting on cartels and what's going on there for over two decades, you're the perfect person to answer this question. And this is almost an impossible one. If you ask a politician this question, you're going to get a wild answer. If they even choose to answer your question as opposed to saying something completely different that you didn't ask, how powerful are the Mexican cartels and how much influence do they actually have?
Yeah. That's a great question. So they're extremely powerful, but I would you need to describe what that power is. And it varies in different parts of Mexico. So they have different levels of control in different states. Mexico is a big country. Mexico is 2 million square kilometers, 32 states. So let's say there's a third of the states in Mexico which don't really have that much cartel activity. They're pretty normal, not really that violent. They're pretty okay. So you could be pretty surprised going somewhere, oh, this is okay.
Yeah.
About a third which have a medium level of cartel activity, where there's cartels are present, but they're not totally dominating the place. And about a third extremely dominated by cartels. Now, what does that look like? So it's different than if, say, when the Islamic State controlled territory in Syria. When they have control of these places, there's certain things they'll control. So they'll control towns. They'll control the mayor of the town. Meaning, I mean, a lot of mayors they've murdered because they haven't taken the money, or they have taken the money and they haven't delivered or whatever. But they'll sometimes, you know, they're going to have them, often they'll have the mayor on their payroll, or they'll even be shaking down the city government, like saying to the mayor, 10% of that budget goes to us. So that's a pretty powerful thing to be able to do that. They'll control and want to put in at both that municipal level and the state level and higher, but particularly that level, police. So like say, we want this guy as the police, this guy as the police, you know, leading police. So there are guys. Now, you have police who are literally full-on cartel members. I mean, carrying out, who might become cartel members first and then be put by the cartel into the police. Often in these towns, cartel really is above, particularly the local city police. And like, you know, I can tell some crazy stories when I've had to deal with cartels in these towns. When the guy said to me, you know, we've had problems and they've, you know, saying you have to leave. And we've said, you know, talk to some of these guys, say, look, we just want to be here. We're not going to. And they say, okay, if you have any problems with the police, you call me. Like they're above the police in these places. Now, they're going to control in these areas all of the illegal activities. And not just drugs, but they're going to, I mean, drugs obviously is a big earner, huge earner still. Drugs going to the United States, fentanyl going to the United States, crystal meth, cocaine, heroin, also what's sold locally in Mexico. But also they've got a bunch of other businesses which they want to take some money off. So there might be theft of oil in that area. If there's oil pipelines going through there, there'll be people plugging in a pipeline to the oil and taking the oil out. They actually plug in two, one to keep the pressure going and one to take the oil out. They'll do that. I mean, it's a crazy amount of money. It's like $1 billion a year. They want a piece of that. Human smuggling. So meaning like all of the people going without papers to the United States, there'll be the coyotes, the polleros, the people running that, but they'll be controlling them as well, taking some of that money. A lot of people that go to the United States, they don't pay, they go legally, but they pay the cartel to enter the United States. In a way, the United States, the cartel is controlling, you know, in a large amount of the US border and a lot of element of there. Now, you know, wildcat mining, prostitution, sex trafficking, product piracy, and then sometimes regular legal businesses also make them pay as well. So basically acting like almost like a shadow government there. Now, at the same time, they can be there. They can, you know, you can be in these places and see them quite openly walking around in camo gear with AK-47s and grenade launchers, that kind of thing. Then the military can go in there, and these guys can disappear. So they're not controlling a territory to the point they're, you know, sometimes stopping the military going. The military can go in there, then the guys can just disappear into the hills, disappear into houses. Then the military goes away, and they come back out again. Now, as you know, like they say about when you talk about, you know, counterinsurgency, techniques, you have to control every square meter of ground because these guys can just disappear. Yep. They can come back and have this constant conflict. They don't care, like, say, the Islamic State or the Shining Path, which is a communist group from Peru in the 1980s, 1990s. They don't care about what people are being taught at schools. You know, the Islamic State, are like, they take a territory. You know, the school teachers have got to teach Islamic education. The Shining Path, they've got to teach communist education. These cartels, don't care. Teacher, yeah, go to school, teach the kids. Yeah, we don't care. They want the government to collect the garbage. They want the government to keep the lights on. But they want to be able to control certain things. So that's what I mean when you understand what cartel or paramilitary organized crime looks like on the ground in these places.
I mean, that's it seems like a spider, but instead of having eight legs, I mean, from what you described is 20 legs or 30 legs or a tick, I guess, would be a better analogy, where they're multi-headed tick, where they're biting into the oil and biting into all the things that are making money. I mean, it's a what you're describing is a pretty robust infrastructure for sure.
Absolutely. A tick. So that's quite a good metaphor, something there. I kind of think of it sometimes as being like, say you have a forest and this is like this kind of noxious weed which is wrapped around certain trees.
Yeah.
And it's kind of sucking from those trees, but also then it gets to a point where, because the police are under control of the cartel, then you can't kind of tell between the regular police and the, you know, and the cartel. You can't tell between certain trees and this noxious weed. They become like this plant. You can't, you know, divide which one is which. But at the same time, we don't want to burn down the whole forest, meaning that Mexico's still got loads of good things as well. And even the Mexican government has good sides as well. Like the Mexican government has, you know, school teachers and doctors and all these people trying to do good work for their communities, but also, you know, this kind of real noxious cartel there as well. So how do you manage to change that? And that's a very, very tough task.
When you were talking about the individuals in camouflage with AKs and grenade launchers, where are they getting this type of weaponry?
Yeah, so first of all, okay, we can divide it between AK-47s, AR-15s, and then heavier weapons. So the AK-47s, the AR-15s are coming, the majority come from the United States. And there are some other sources, but it's, you know, I've looked at this very, very heavily. You see how people are buying these guns in the US. Now, they're buying them through straw buyers, you know, which paying people with clean records to go in and buy guns. And, you know, the cases are there. I mean, you know, yeah, you've got the guns, you know, in, you know, tens and tens of thousands of guns traced directly to stores, to factories and so forth. Now they'll go in there and they'll buy multiple, there's been cases of multiple sales where they'll walk into a store and say, give me 10, you know, what is a 10 AK-47s. Boom, buy them. Now they'll do that. And then they'll buy some through private sales as well. Some other methods. Now, when I talk to some of the ATF agents about this, they're like, what can really stop this? So one of the problems is that, like, it's not even about introducing new laws, it's simply about enforcing the laws on the books, and they're not being enforced. So whereas, like, a straw purchaser, and you look at these cases, and there's one case I looked at where a guy bought 10 AK-47s for a cartel in Mexico called the Zetas. They went down to Mexico. This is a guy in the US in Texas who was buying weed off this guy who gave him $600 plus the price of the guns to buy these guns, collected them, delivered the guns to him. He took them down, the guns taken down to Mexico, and they were used shooting dead an American agent in Mexico, Jaime Zapata. In that case, they made an effort to trace the guns and everything and found out who bought them. And he got, you know, I guess how much jail time he did? Zero.
I was going to say stern warning.
Probation.
Which is wild, because you're talking about a straw man purchase. I mean, that's a federal crime.
Yeah. So the crime he did then was lying on the form.
Yeah.
But they've actually, you know, since this, I said to the ATF guy, what do you do? Give these guys sentence, give them jail time for doing that. Put up. Because also what happens, you get a thing where the ATF agents catch these guys doing straw buying. They say, we've got this. Take it to the prosecutors. Prosecutors go, well, why would I bother prosecuting that case for? They won't go and do any jail time. So they try and build up and follow them around and build a big conspiracy case, and then it all goes kind of crazy and goes wrong. So simply give these guys, you know, if you're buying, you know, buying guns for a cartel, you know who these guys are. They're going to commit mass murder with these guns. You know, there's now one thing that would be interesting, and it, you know, we can get into discussing this, but if they were classified as terrorist groups, the cartels, that would very much change it, because you would no longer just be doing straw purchasing, you'd be providing material for a terrorist organization.
I was going to ask you about the terrorist designation. I've talked with a few people, even from a policy perspective in the U.S. Most people educated on this topic, it's one of the first things that they say. If you could switch the classification of the cartels from, I actually don't even know what they are right now, probably just a cartel, to a terrorist organization, it would change the tools that would be available, and it could be addressed in a different manner. Do you think it would have a large impact?
In itself, it would certainly change the tools, but still it's very open as to what is going to be the US strategy for dealing with this problem. And we've got kind of multi problems that come from this. So let's say we say, well, if we designate them as a terrorist organization, and then that gives us the legal power to carry out a drone strike, because, you know, this is a terrorist organization threatening us. Now, you could do this, or the military could do this, but that's not going to finish these cartels off. I mean, like, not only, you know, you look at Afghanistan and where things didn't work out in Afghanistan, but like here, you know, this is not like Al-Qaeda or something where you have a certain small number of groups kind of doing plotting terrorist activities. You're talking about an industry with now, I mean, conservative numbers are like, you know, 150,000, 170,000 employees.
Yeah.
Conservative, there's a study in Science that I think it's likely higher than that.
You're not going to solve that problem with a drone overhead and a Hellfire missile.
Exactly. So you got to think, okay, so even if you took out, now, apart from if you did that, or if the military did that, then immediately it creates a diplomatic issue with Mexico. You're going to say you can just take out these guys, a lot of issues then. And, you know, Mexico and the United States do share now $500 billion in cross-border trade. I can understand the frustration of people when you have fentanyl carrying out this level of death in the United States. I mean, don't get me wrong, that level of death should not be happening. That is completely unprecedented. To have more than 100,000 people dying every year of overdose in the United States is absolutely terrible. This is a serious issue. I can understand the, you know, really there is, you know, big in the United States and in Mexico, big problem with the level of organized crime in Mexico, the level of what they are. And I can understand this being a real concern to the United States and to Mexico. But it's a deep problem, and often, you know, just the idea that this can be solved with a couple of missiles or strikes, I think, is mistaken.
There's a lot of things I like about the Mountain Tough program, but I think primarily what I enjoy is they focus on mental toughness in addition to just the physical toughness. Everything they do is grounded in one purpose: life transformations and being strong between the years in the mind. And there's also a community of 15,000 plus Mountain Tough athletes. So the community is strong, they're supportive, and they're going to help keep you accountable. So you can train anywhere, you can stream anywhere, you can access guided training and on-demand workouts right from your phone, your tablet, or TV or computer, whatever you're into. And everything you need is in one spot. The Mountain Tough subscription gets you access to all the Mountain Tough programs, new programs, and bonus content. And they have programs for everyone. Those who hit the gym and heavy weights, those who like to work out at home with no gear or minimal gear, and everything in between. Mountain Tough has been the trusted training by the dedicated for years now, including U.S. military special forces and dedicated backcountry hunters. There is no excuse for you to not start today. With Mountain Tough, you can conquer your goals with the ideal program for your lifestyle and schedule. Train with equipment or just your body weight on your phone, tablet, TV, or web browser.
Most importantly, they will help you train your mindset so you are always ready for anything that life throws your way. Mountain Tough subscribers get full access to world-class home and gym programs, groundbreaking mental toughness training, self-improvement, prehab and rehab, biomechanical form coaching, stretching and mobility flows, nutrition guidance, challenge workouts, and the global Mountain Tough community. Mountain Tough is offering Change Agents listeners an incredible offer. You're going to get 40% off on the all-new Mountain Tough Plus annual subscription with the code CHANGEAGENTS. Go to mtntough.com and enter the code CHANGEAGENTS to receive 40% off, a savings of about $100 on your Mountain Tough Plus annual subscription. That is MTN, Mike Tango November, tough.com, and enter the code CHANGEAGENTS to save 40%. That is less than 50 cents per day for the best in-class physical and mental training. This episode is also brought to you by Montana Knife Company. This is one of my favorite brands, and I am so proud of the fact that they wanted to be involved with Change Agents. The founder, Josh Smith, one of the most experienced master bladesmiths in the world, has become a personal friend. He lives just a few hours down the road in Frenchtown, Montana, and I have absolutely fallen in love with the Montana Knife Company blades. Josh has been making knives for 30 years, and he founded MKC here in the beautiful state of Montana to create the most functional blades for an outdoor lifestyle, manufactured locally here in Montana. They're designed, tested, and built by hunters. MKC is a hunting knife company, first and foremost, and they produce the sharpest knives out of the box and some of the easiest knives to sharpen. They're a young company, and they're working hard to keep up with demand. If you're familiar with this brand, you know what I'm talking about. From time to time, it can be a challenge to get a hold of some of their blades. And one of the things that is their most requested and that some people may not even know about is their culinary set. These knives are unbelievable. I was fortunate enough, and by that I mean I forced them to send me a set of these or I wasn't going to do the ad read for them. If you're serious about cooking, you need these in your kitchen. These sets are going to be back in stock for Black Friday, but this will be a limited everyday in stock, meaning they're not going to release their full inventory so that they have enough for the holiday gift buying season. If you can get your hands on one of these sets, I cannot say enough good things about them. Also right now, and for the first time ever, they actually have some of their knives in stock full-time on the site. You can go grab yourself a Blackfoot 2.0, a Speedgo, which is my absolute favorite daily driver knife, and a Stonewall Skinner. If you use the code CHANGEAGENTS10, you're going to get 10% off your first order. That is CHANGEAGENTS with 10 at the end of it for 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company, working knives for working people. What would you describe the U.S. policy or approach to the cartels as right now?
I would say right now, the United States has an unclear strategy. And what I mean is you look at different government departments have different ideas, and they haven't really got a thought out strategy about this. If you look at, now, first of all, the DEA, you know, the people who are dealing with drug cartels, dealing with drug traffickers. And, you know, I spent a lot of time talking to DEA agents over the years doing this. Really like a lot of them on a personal level. You know, I know these guys are like, you know, brave. Some of these guys, they're infiltrating cartels and really getting in there. But the thing is about the DEA guys is they are, I would say, very mission orientated, but not really strategy orientated. They haven't really, you know, the guys, I mean, you know, these DEA guys are like, get in there, get in the weeds with these guys, you know, bring down. So they're like, bring down El Chapo. That's the big mission, take down El Chapo. But then you take down El Chapo, you know, they arrested him. Okay, he was arrested, escaped, arrested again, extradited, convicted, you know, convicted early 2019, and you know, it's only got worse since then. Now we've got, you know, worse fentanyl deaths than ever.
Yeah,
but that didn't solve things. You know, you got on a mission. That was great. They got the mission. They take to come down. So now they go after the Chapo's sons, the Chapitos. You know, the little Chapos. He's got these four sons who are trafficking. They bring those guys down. But then there's some problems when you look at how this works. Then the way they do is to bring down El Chapo, they're like, okay, we're going to give deals to a bunch of other narcos to testify against him. So you look at these deals, and I say, I mean, the guy we interviewed, published an interview with, Mini Leak, he did a deal, came out after 5 years. He's a major trafficker and involved in a lot of things, came out after 5 years. So what are, you know, you're giving people a certain get out clause. They can traffic drugs and then make a deal and then come live a life in the United States. So that creates a certain flaw in the strategy there in a way.
Yeah, for sure.
So what are these guys? And some of them get paid a lot of money because they can then inform and be paid money. So then, you know, it's kind of interesting how that works. But these DEA guys are getting results and the prosecutor's getting results and bringing down the target, but at what cost? Then you've got, the foreign relations. So foreign relations, their thing is simply, okay, we're dealing with Mexico as a foreign partner. Now, going back, then you get sometimes, you know, the foreign relations and also the CIA on their missions. So before it was, you know, for a long time, again, you know, bring down communism, fight communism. Then who do you ally with to fight communism? You know, you ally with, you know, the government of South Vietnam, but then they're corrupt and moving drugs. You know, you ally with, you know, Noriega in Panama, and then he ends up, you know, he's convicted in the US court, and he was a CIA payroll, and that's all very, very documented. In Afghanistan,
then I was just going to say the Mujahideen, and we'll support a proxy war against communism, and then, oh shit, we're getting shot at by our own weapons.
Yeah, and then you support them against communism, and then, but also then, to, so it becomes radical Islam becomes the enemy, and again, a very legitimate enemy, but then bring down the Northern Alliance, Afghanistan were moving out huge amounts of heroin. Now most of it was going to Europe, but Afghanistan, with all the $2 trillion of US aid, is pumping out heroin. Since the Taliban took over, the heroin production in Afghanistan has gone down 95%. So, you know, what's happening now with China? I mean, the fentanyl's, you know, China's now biggest or second biggest trading partner of the United States, also owns a lot of US debt. And then what's China doing with this fentanyl? So then you've got a cross there of like, well, you've got on one side the DA agents and DHS agents trying to investigate and go after these guys, and then you've got kind of other government people overriding this and so I would say that the strategy is confused. You've got the strategy of and a lot of this stuff is interlinked. You've got the southern border problem or the southern border issues. You've got record numbers claiming asylum in the United States. Now, some of the asylum claims are bogus, but some of them are real asylum claims. You look at the talk of these people, they're running from gangsters, from governments, but some of them are running from these same gangsters who are getting drug money and getting guns coming down. So I would say the United States hasn't got a clear strategy about, and then we get to the United States itself. What's the current strategy for dealing with the fentanyl crisis?
Couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
That's got to be so frustrating for people like the DA and the ATF, because the agents that you're talking to, they don't get to set policy. You know, they're expected to execute policy. And if it shifts like a flag in the wind, and they have to navigate inside of the rule set that they're given, I can only imagine how frustrating that is. But from what I have been able to determine, your description of the policy being either confusing or nebulous, or a lot of people would say we don't have one at all, it's concerning. You've brought up fentanyl quite a few times, and I live in northwestern Montana, 60 miles from the Canadian border. Fentanyl from Mexico is killing people up here every day. And, you know, our source cities, it comes up the coast, probably crosses in Tijuana, because it seems like, talking to my law enforcement friends, our source cities are on the West Coast. So it comes up the coast, it comes inward, and there's a lot of actual trading for firearms, which, you know, it's interesting, that book right over your shoulder, Blood Gun Money, and the ties to how these things, people here locally who are addicted, who can no longer afford it, will oftentimes look for things that they can trade upstream for drugs. So we're talking about handguns or rifles, and this is a hunting culture up here, so it's not uncommon for people to have rifles or ARs. Not that I think that's a great deer caliber, but whatever, you know, fly your Second Amendment flag all you want to and your Montana flag, but they trade it upstream and it works its way back. But it's killing people at a rate that is absolutely shocking, and I'm not so sure that the U.S. government has a solid approach to it, or maybe even an understanding. And I'm curious, given your time covering the cartel, it seems like when you first got to Mexico City, you'd see traditional drugs. You know, I'm sure weed and cocaine and heroin, and you were talking about crack cocaine. When did you start hearing about fentanyl?
Yeah, sure. So I would, if I could just prologue the move to fentanyl with meth, because I think this is connected. I think what we've seen in the last couple of years is a revolution in drugs, from the plant-based drugs to synthetic drugs. With these,
meth is a fan favorite up here too.
Yeah, so right in there. So this is with catastrophic consequences, and it's changed the way, you know. Because when I was, you know, talking about weed before, you know, grass, it was like legalize this stuff. You know, it's marijuana. Why are they, you know, everyone killing each other over marijuana? Fentanyl's a different ballgame. So. First of all, you know, what you get is you get in the early 2000s, you get Mexican cartels moving into the meth trade in a massive way. Some of it was in the US. They start trying to fight meth in the US. You used to have like bikers make up meth in bathtubs and stuff. And they had 2005 Combat Methamphetamine Act, made it harder to do it in the United States. So they came down to Mexico, started doing it in Mexico. Now, what they started doing was they started hooking up then with Chinese pharmaceutical companies, providing the raw ingredients, and Mexican cartels making the meth. There was a guy called Shen Li Yigong, was a Chinese-born guy, naturalized Mexican, and he was one of the first guys who really made this connection. He was making so much money doing this, bringing in the precursors, bring them into the port in Mexico, Manzanillo, the biggest port in Mexico, Manzanillo, Colima, huge port, 3 million containers going through there a year, straight line to China, bringing this stuff there, selling it to this gangster called Arturo Beltran Leyva, one of the big Mexican drug traffickers, friend of El Chapo's. And he had so much money in his house in Mexico City, he had a mansion here in Mexico City, with $207 million in cash. In the house. Raided. He was flying up to Vegas with suitcases full of money and was spending in Vegas. He spent more than $100 million in Vegas. Now, Vegas,
wow.
The casinos were so happy with this, they would give him, like, oh, bring him, here's a flash car, here's this. There was one Chinese woman dealer he liked, became his girlfriend. He bought her $1 million house. You know, like he was winning 40% back. Eventually the casinos got done for this. They had to give some of his money back to the US government. When they raided his house in Mexico City, he was up in Vegas. He went underground. I was working at the time for the Associated Press news agency. He went underground in the United States. He was being looked for. And then he approached us at the news agency to give us an interview. We interviewed him up at the sent some people up in the United States. We interviewed him in New York City. We sent Chinese speakers, Spanish speakers, and English speakers. He spoke all of them with an accent. He had like this weird like Chinese dialect, spoke Spanish with a funny accent and stuff. Came out with this crazy story, was it a long, he came out and said, came with this crazy story saying, oh, the Mexican government, it was a Mexican politician's money, and he just threatened me and said, you take this money in your house and look after it for me, or I'm gonna kill you.
It's kind of crazy. It's a cool story. $200 million, I need you to store at your house.
Yeah. And anyway, eventually he's extradited down here. He's still in prison right here. He's still fighting. His house is still up there recently. He was still fighting to try and get his house back. But he was one of the real innovators who made this connection. So from there, you had the Mexican cartels build up, go crazy with crystal meth. And then they started fentanyl. Now, we have this in the interview with the mini leaker, who was from Sinaloa cartel. And he said they first started seeing fentanyl in 2013. When they said 10 years ago, they first started seeing it. Now, they first started seeing it come in what they call China whites or synthetic chiva, which is heroin with fentanyl inside it. So that is kind of, it's heroin gives you an extra kick. Now, I don't know how conscious they were about this, like, we're going to, you know, steer the consumers a certain direction. Because what I don't know if it just happened this way or they're that smart about thinking this through. But they, 2013, they first started seeing synthetic chiba. Now, he said this. They sent guys to China and they were shown exactly what to do. They went there and they were saying, this is how you do it. This is what you need. The guys in China, I mean, again, I don't know these are, sometimes these are government run pharmacies in China, some of the independent pharmacies. But they went to China and they're being shown what to do. They said 2014, all of these cartel guys investing in this, they were making huge amounts of money. Like, bang, making this money. Now, people start getting hooked on heroin with fentanyl in the United States. So they became, oh, that heroin's pretty strong. You know, that's stronger than the heroin before. You know, that can be an extra boost. Deaths go up. But then it becomes, oh, I don't want regular heroin. I need that heroin with the extra kick.
Yep.
And then it becomes, forget the heroin and we just give you straight the fentanyl. So again, I don't know how much they were, that was a deliberate pushing of the market in that direction, like gradually getting you there, or it was the way they did it. But then it became pure fentanyl, so we don't need to grow. Now, the switch has been fairly recent. You see, the gradually goes up, but the real switch has been the last 3 years, where you suddenly see, for the first time, about 3 years ago, you first time you see seizures at the southern border, more fentanyl than heroin. And then it goes like that. You know, meaning that, you know, it becomes many times and the seizures explode. And for them, they don't have to worry about the opium poppers. They don't have to worry about harvesting. They don't have to worry about paying campesinos. They don't have to worry about the military spraying cops. It's just bringing the precursors, make it wherever they want. They can make this stuff. And the profits, you know, are off the charts. And so is the level of death in the United States, in your home state and right across the U.S.
Hey, everybody. We're going to take a brief pause from the interview so I can tell you a little bit about Fabric by Gerber Life. As a parent, there's nothing that keeps me up at night more or scares me more than something happening to my children. And a lot of people think when it comes to insurance that you're trying to insure yourself for yourself, and that's the exact opposite the way I view it when it comes to life insurance. I think of insuring myself to make sure that if something were to happen with me, it's actually my children and loved ones left behind that are taken care of. That's where Fabric by Gerber Life comes in. It was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. They have more than just life insurance. You can manage everything from wills, college savings funds, and your family's finances right from your phone. They have over 1,700 five-star reviews, and they're rated as excellent in Trustpilot. I urge you to join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes. That's meetfabric.com/changeagents. M-E-E-T, Mike Echo Echo Tango, fabric.com/changeagents. Policies are issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company, and they're not available in certain states. Prices are subject to underwriting and health questions. Hey there, everybody. Before we get back to the interview, if you want to grab a hat or a shirt like the one I'm wearing right now, go visit shop.thisisironclad.com and use the code CHANGEAGENTS. That's going to be all one word, all caps, for 15% off of your order. Ironclad just restocked their inventory, so get them before they're gone. And make sure to follow them anywhere at This Is Ironclad to stay in the know for exclusive collaborations that are going to be coming soon. That's shop.thisisironclad.com, code CHANGEAGENTS. One word, all caps. It's going to get you 15% off of your order. All right, let's get back to the show. Which, you know, presents them with an interesting problem. Not that people weren't dying on the substances that were coming across the border before, but, I mean, almost every public servant I know is issued Narcan now. I mean, that is how common it is. And I know parents who have teenage kids who have Narcan at the house because they understand that
at a certain age, whether you tell them to or not, there's going to be a level of exploration in there. And they're understanding the lethality of this. It seems like, I mean, the profit margin might be through the roof, but you also have the potential to kill off your consumer base. And I'm wondering if you've heard any rumblings inside of the cartel about that concern, or are they just foot to the gas pedal to the floor and make as much money as you can while you can?
I mean, it's a very good question. It's something I thought about myself. One thing, you know, as long as they're making money, and some of these guys don't care. Some of them don't care because, you know, they're... In a way, when I talk to some of these drug traffickers, and it's weird that you can find kind of human sides to them when you talk to them. I talk to them about committing murder. I talk to them about what they do. I talk about their experience of violence and all these kind of things. Sometimes you can find these human sides. But I say a lot of them have kind of made a pact with the devil, and I use that in a metaphorical way. But in a way, it's like a real way. I mean, like they've made a pact. Like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to commit murder. I'm going to do this. And that's the life I've chosen. That's me now. So they don't care. But also, I think it, and I do think this is a factor. When you're trafficking drugs to a different country, to different people in different places, it's like easier to care less about it.
To disassociate it.
Yeah, I think so, because then, now I'll get into this in a second, they ban some fentanyl sales in their own communities. When they know their kids are going to school to these places, this is Australia, this is kind of, so you have like Sinaloa, a big drug trafficking place, and they're like, no one's allowed to sell fentanyl here. Now they know that their kids are at school and their families are at school, they don't want the fentanyl, or their own guys, they don't want their own guys messing with this stuff. Even the guys who are mixing it, they don't say, don't take this stuff. Ban it here. Now, initially that was the same for crystal meth, and now crystal meth use is really rising in Mexico. And the same could start happening with fentanyl. So there's definitely a real issue of, like, you know, this stuff can get worse. But like, there is right now, and it's kind of hard to read this, it's always hard to, like, say the world of cartels is smoke and mirrors. They're now claiming in Sinaloa, which is, you know, the big place of production, to have banned the production of fentanyl. Saying, and they've actually got big banners out with these words saying, nobody sells fentanyl, nobody makes fentanyl right now. Now, there's different theories about this. One is it's simply a way, because they know that, you know, the American DEA, the American government's really gunning for these top guys right now over fentanyl. It's like created heat on them. So they're trying to use that to kind of deflect. It could also be to get people out, an excuse to get people who have not, you know, are not paying them. But it's hard to know. I mean, could they really try and remodel their business again and just say, go back to cocaine and, you know, say, well, you know, we should take this back a bit. Maybe this is, because it has risen the heat in the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, you're talking in the United States, people are talking about, well, we're going to make them terrorists, we've got to bomb Mexico. And a lot of that is the result of fentanyl deaths. You know, that's what's causing this reaction. Someone could be realizing, is this going to, but yeah, I mean, about in terms of how much, and it's unprecedented. It's unprecedented to have 100,000 plus people dying every year of this, you know, like, it's, and it's young, healthy people. Many people are dying. It's not like it's just like people who are old and frail, a lot of like COVID deaths or whatever. It's young, healthy people who can be, you know, real healthy, young, 18, 20 years old, you take a pill and bang, you're dead. I mean, this stuff is really lethal. So
it seems to largely be accidental. It's people who, yeah, from, again, talking to my law enforcement friends locally, the seriousness of the issue is not from people looking for fentanyl. It's them accidentally stumbling across fentanyl and something that they're taking a pill that they thought was something else, you know, or smoking something or snorting something that they thought was something else. And the next thing you know, they're face down.
Absolutely. Yeah. And these, I mean, again, sometimes it's hard to figure out why they'll get cocaine and they'll shove fentanyl in cocaine. It's like you deliberately trying to poison people.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be a good strategy. Not that I'm an expert in cocaine by any stretch, but That one doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, some of it I think is like, you got a kilo of cocaine. And say that kilo of cocaine costs you $20,000. And you can, you know, sell it, you know, a bit down the road for $40,000, $50,000. But you put some fentanyl in it and some other stuff, and then suddenly you got 3-4 kilos of cocaine. You know, you're making it, because this stuff is such a powerful substance.
Yeah.
But then you're creating this kind of venomous thing. So that's one explanation of it, but it's crazy. I mean, we have to see how much will this burn itself out, or how much would you just get more and more people. Now, it's not only the people dying of fentanyl. So I grew up around a lot of drug use in England, and I talked to people, you know, new people who were like taking heroin. And since I've been doing my work reporting on this, I've been around these places and talked to people who have been like heroin addicts and people who've been into all kinds of drugs. And you could, even though they were, you know, heroin users, you could talk to them and so forth. You see some of the people who are like on fentanyl and meth, and some of them, and it sounds a bit of a dehumanizing language, but some of them are like zombies.
I was going to use the same term. It's like, yeah, they're existing on another plane.
Yeah. So it's also like really damaging and creating this kind of a group of people, which is just like, you know, so yeah, I mean, the damage to society is really, really big. I mean, and there needs to be I think the United States needs to have a real clear strategy to say, this is a number one. I mean, it says various issues. So you've got like a big health issue in the United States, real big, but also a big issue of law enforcement in Mexico. Now, I would say one thing about the United States is the United States and England, you know, the same problems. We had this idea, we had the Cold War, and in the Cold War, we had this idea, okay, it was kind of, we had a strategy. Now, it had its problems, like we discussed. You know, you say, oh, somebody's anti-communist, they're going to be with them, but they might be, you know, dealing drugs or killing people, whatever. But anyway, there was a strategy there. It was support and fight communism. That was the foreign policy. Then you had this idea, the Cold War finishes, and then this idea of we're going to kind of be the police of the world and kind of being, all countries are going to become like us. And that's kind of failed. So really, the US also needs to kind of rethink foreign policy. So with, I would say, just take it back, but Mexico is right on the border. I would say you can't solve the problems in Afghanistan. You can't solve the problems in a lot of countries right across the world. But try and support the countries. Now, again, it's difficult when you have the level of corruption in Mexico, the violence, but still support some of the programs. It makes it safer for the United States to have a safer Mexico, to not to have this level of violence. Now, exactly how that happens, you know, can you support some of the programs to try and steer the guys away from the crime and move into the cartels, and then the Mexican government has to try and take care of law enforcement, has to kind of revitalize itself to try and take care of the actual cartels themselves. Still challenging, but maybe, you know, that has to be, you know, think about, and then reducing the level of, now, one thing in terms of actually stopping the fentanyl, which I think they're going to go to more in the United States, is hit the dealers with murder charges. Now, they're talking about doing that in various places. And that's, you know, we'll see if America has the stomach for that, if you really want to lock up people on murder charges for selling a drug. But that's, you know, that's one thing which is, I think is going to happen. It's going to be happening.
That's a big stick. I don't know if it would have the impact for some people, you know, given how they're choosing to live their life. But that's certainly, that has more teeth than what I have seen locally being applied to distributors and dealers, for sure. Do you think that the Mexican government is capable of dismantling the cartels?
You know, it's got to be it's a Herculean challenge, and it's got to be a long term thing. I would say, I mean, like right now, it's not going to do this. You know, like, one of the problems as well is New Mexico faces multiple cartels all over the country. It's not only, you know, one or two to take down. It's like a bunch of these. And then what we found out from the last few years is even if you come down and you hit and break and cut the head off a snake of one, it becomes multiple snakes.
Yep.
And then some of these are like, you know, like you see this, the fragments of the fragments of the fragments. I mean, there used to be this powerful guy I mentioned before, Arturo Beltran Leyva, who was the guy who's big into creating crystal meth. Very, very powerful drug trafficker. Mexican government took him down. Now, the Mexican government are corrupt, but they maybe took him down to help the rivals, but they took him down. Mexican Marines shot him dead in Cuernavaca near here, near Mexico City. They shot him dead and decorated his body with dollar bills that he had. One of the Marines, it was Mexican Marines who went in there and took him down. One of the Marines died in the shootout. And it was told he was a hero on TV. The cartel went to the wake of his funeral and killed his sister, his mother, like a whole bunch of members of his family of the Marine who died. I mean, that's...
It's a hell of a message.
Crazy things you're dealing with. But anyway, he was taken down, Arturo Beltran Leyva. So then below him, you suddenly had a group called Los Guerreros Unidos, a group called Los Rojos, who were like his lieutenants created their own crews. They started taking down some of them, and then some of their lieutenants started creating their own crews. Till you had this one guy who's kind of like the lieutenant of a lieutenant of a lieutenant, this guy's like 22 years old, controlling a chunk of the state of Guerrero with like 200 kids, literally kids from like age like 10 upwards. And I had a couple of friends of mine, with journalists, ran into these guys. Like 200 kids, literally, like crazy, like Children of the Corn stuff, kids with AKs. They held them up. They took all their vehicles. They took all their laptops, you know, grabbed all the stuff. And it was like, so this is the kind of the fragments you're going to be dealing with. So again, it's like, how do you have to have a... So there needs to be a strategy. I would say, first of all, Mexico even needs to say basic stuff, control roads, control city centers, push the cartels back. Try and say the most violent cartel people we're going to take out. You know, no kidnapping for ransom. Pushing back. And then it's got to, like, you've got to deal with the new generation. So it's like, you know, there was a kid, there was a kid known as Juan Pistolas, Juanitos Pistolas. He was like a kid who's recruited at 13 years old in Nuevo Laredo, the city that I was used to cover back in the day for the Houston Chronicle. When I first covered this in 2004, this kid was like just being born. Next thing you know, a few years later, this guy's been recruited at 13. He was apparently an orphan. His parents were killed in the cartel warfare. He was recruited at 13 as an orphan. And he became infamous. There were songs about him, like raps about him in the city. Juanito Pistolas, he's like photos of him. It's like, you know, young, 17 years old. He got to 17. He had a shootout with the army. He got literally his head blown off. His head was blown off his shoulders in his gunfight. So how do you save that new generation of kids? You know, you have to do focused social work. Focused work with like, okay, we've got to kind of demilitarize this level of kids. And then you've got to say, you know, how do you create effective... I mean, right now you're creating more and more power in the army. Now, I don't know if you follow El Salvador, the situation in El Salvador.
Can't say that I am.
They got a president in El Salvador who's been a very hard line. He's gone for mass incarceration, but he's been very effective at stopping gangs. Controversial. I was down there end of last year looking at that situation in El Salvador. But mass incarceration, but they have reduced the murder rate massively. So, you know, they can. I think there has to be a solution at some point. But it's going to be some years before this. You know, the best you can hope for, I think, is to try and make it on the right direction, and try and have kind of murder rate go down, and try and, you know, win back some territory.
Any thoughts on how, from somebody who lives in the U.S., that we could reduce the flow of drugs from Mexico to the United States? I mean, there's obviously, of course, dealing with the demand side of the house, which is a conversation in and of itself, very complicated. But from a logistical perspective, you think there's any way that we could interrupt their ability? Because it doesn't seem like anything that we have... I mean, how long have we been fighting the war on drugs? It's a couple decades. I think the jury has come back and said, we're not really winning that one.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if you have any ideas on things that could reduce the flow of drugs from south to north.
Yeah, you know, like one thing I think is that in the experience of really what has reduced drugs in a big way, it's been very authoritarian governments. So what I mean is like the Taliban right now, I mean, I'm not saying these guys are, you know, in any way good, but these guys, like, you know, we catch you with opium, we'll chop your head off.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff works. You know, real hard line. In the Philippines, under Duterte, they were like, you know, shooting dead drug dealers, and President Duterte came out saying, you know, I'm going to fill the Bay of Manila with the bodies of, you know, give the fish some corpses to eat, fill them with the corpses of drug dealers.
Damn.
has an impact. China, funny enough, Red China under Mao Zedong, when it first came in, they were like, opium is an imperialist vice coming from foreigners. You know, we catch you at re-education camp. Bang. So it's very authoritarian, non-democratic societies. You know, if you have that, you know, it's a bit like that in El Salvador right now against gangs. It's not really a drug issue so much as a bit as gang issue. You know, they gang. But basically, it's like, in El Salvador, no civil rights. You know, we think you're a gang member. We've heard you're a gang member. We've got suspicion. You're in prison. Bang. And we'll give you 25 years in prison. And that's it. And you're not seeing your family. You're not talking to your family by phone. You've got no contact. So this kind of stuff that's hard for a lot of societies to stomach, and it's saying that's not the kind of society we want to live in, but those are the ones that are effective. But if we don't live in that, and say Mexico, it's not like Mexicans want to, you know, if you really had a Mexican, you know, government come in and said, you know, any official is caught with drugs, execution. And, you know, any of these, you know, death penalty, and there's no death penalty in Mexico right now, but there's 35,000 murders a year. That kind of thing could maybe really just like a very, very heavy-handed government. But it's hard, you know, to have the same in the United States, like saying, if you wanted to say, like in the United States, okay, anybody caught selling drugs, we're going to give you life in prison. Bang, that's it.
You'd have people up in arms. It grates against people's desire for freedom.
Yeah. So if we don't want, you know, and I'm saying I don't, you know, and I like freedom myself. So like, if we don't want that, then what do we do? If we're saying these kind of, you know, it's quite pretty hard to try and, like I said, we tried. I mean, you know, Richard Nixon came in, you know, in 1971, he declared drugs public enemy number one. Now it's been, that war on drugs has been self-sabotaged as well. So it's been self-sabotaged by, you know, making allowances with drug traffickers, by this process of giving drug traffickers a way out. So it's kind of a, you could say, well, we haven't quite tried it properly yet. And you've got to like make it a better war on drugs. You know, we've got to try and deal with this corruption. Or you could say, well, we're going to have to try something different altogether. And you're going to say, you know, still though, then how, what does that really mean? So you could say, okay, we're allowing legal weed. No, we're not going to chase people for marijuana anymore. But what are we going to do with fentanyl? We're going to have to just be very, very big programs. I mean, they can, look, it's very tough. And I realize, you know, I've been doing this for 23 years and, you know, I don't know easy answers. I mean, maybe if the DEA weren't doing what they're doing, it'd be even worse. So maybe they're reducing the amount coming in and there'd be even more fentanyl if they weren't doing this stuff. Maybe they weren't chasing down these guys and spending billions chasing down these guys and extraditing them and making these deals and so forth. It would be worse still. But in the short term, if there was pressure on Mexico and if Mexico tried to hit the ports, so right now you've got the port of Manzanillo, biggest port in Mexico. A lot of precursors coming in there. If they were to like hit that, China, I mean, you know, can you get China to try and be tougher on this? And exactly what is China's?
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Could there be technology at the borders to better detect this stuff coming in? Now, could there be a technological breakthrough which would change this? Now, one thing is, and this is the majority of this are not coming over the desert or over the river. It's coming through the port of entry. It means you're in a car, it's a truck, and the drugs are hidden in the vehicle. They call them trap cars. They call them clavos in Mexico. You've got a, you know, they're pretty sophisticated. Some of these things, like some of those. Now, when you're a customs agent and you've got a vehicle, so you get a good customs agent who sees somebody because you look nervous. I think this could be a guy. But then I've got to tear your car apart. Sometimes it's hidden. You have to like literally get a blowtorch and rip apart some of the car to find the drugs there. You know, you might be wrong, and it's like, could we pay for your car? Or you're right, and you find it and process that, but then some other cars are coming through.
Yeah, the 10 cars behind it, which are also loaded, are passing right through.
Yeah, but if you could have some kind of technology which can detect this stuff, you know, can some kind of, you know, like thing that you could say, vroom, then that could make a difference.
Yeah, that would be... I think that would be impactful. What would you make from a policy change perspective from the United States?
If I was US king with total power over this, I would say, look, we need to create a long-term program of dealing with drugs and organized crime. These are long-term problems affecting our country and affecting our neighbors, affecting our region, that we need to focus on long-term. So we've got to get away from, this is something that's going to change it, you know, just in terms of the long-term, okay. So I'd say, first of all, we need real treatment programs, like hard treatment programs. Then I would say we need to tackle cartels as a serious organized crime threat, not just because they're selling drugs, but because these are very violent organizations which disrupt democracy. And what I've been describing in Mexico could be a reality in the United States within a generation. I think, you know, these are all over the United States, these organizations. They're being more low key right now, yeah, because they're making cash. They don't want to disrupt, they don't want to do borders, but they're entrenched. So you've got, you know, RICO charges. I'd say you need to really push, you know, maybe the I know the terrorist thing again. I said we discussed our terrorist thing is about terrorists is discussing, and it was created really for political adversaries with political agendas. This idea of terrorists. So, like, say you have Al Qaeda, and it's like they're terrorists, we'll take them out. But like these cartels are different. They've got huge amounts of people working for them. And they're really embedding industries. So maybe sharpen the teeth of organized crime legislation or cartel legislation. Maybe, you know, you need to combat cartel act and classify these things and say, okay, we've got to stop them boot up in the United States and have maybe enhanced powers to go after them. Again, not necessarily bombing, but like enhanced powers of being able to take them down without, sometimes it takes a long time. You look at what the DEA go through. Now, the thing about the DEA as well, the DEA care about drugs. So they're going to sometimes, you know, you look at these trials in the US courts, and I went to the trial of El Chapo, and they'll describe the stuff he's doing in Mexico, but they're going after him for the drugs. But really, they, you know, saying these are cartels, these organizations which are threatening our region. So also if they've committed, you know, massacres, you know, United States should be interested in that. They've committed, you know, they've buried 300 bodies in the ground. They've rigged elections. I mean, you know, these guys, so the interview again, we had this guy was saying, we helped rig the Mexican election in 2012, that we have our guys, we'll stand up, we'll move the guys in these areas to vote, we'll deliver votes in return. But also they've had a US court case in about a Jamaican drug lord, Darius Coke, saying the same, I rigged an election in Jamaica. You know, we rigged an election up there. That's what we did. We rig elections for the government and they give us immunity. Central America, same thing. So these are, you know, combating these organizations for threatening, and you know, you don't want to that can happen in the United States. So all of these things can happen down here. So maybe something like that, maybe a kind of maybe rather than going down a, you know, trying to create a write a solid, you know, long term strategy for fighting drugs and for fighting cartels, and maybe a reinforced, robust anti-cartel legislation.
Yeah, actually, I like all of that. Final question for you, to be respectful of your time. One of the things that frustrates me the most right now about culture in the United States is that information is no longer presented for people to make up their own mind with. It's editorialized at best and more than likely weaponized. You can use the border as an example. One political party says it's totally secure. The other one says it's wide open. People, and I don't blame them for this, they don't know where to go to get information with which they can educate themselves, absent whatever bias or positioning that somebody may be trying to push them towards. So for anybody who watches or listens to this and they want to understand it better, do you have any resources that you could point them towards that are at least as close to non-bias as possible so that they can just educate, inform, and make up their own mind as opposed to just repeating what other people tell them to say?
Yeah, sure thing. So I think I totally agree and sympathize with this. I mean, I've worked in, you know, the media for 23 years, and I had two Time magazine front covers and over 50 op-eds in the New York Times. And now I do independent journalism, and I became disillusioned and sometimes heartbroken with a lot of things that happened in the profession.
Yeah.
And I agree. I think a lot of the time you get journalists with a cauldron of opinions and a teaspoon of knowledge.
Oh, I like, I'm stealing that from you immediately.
Yeah. As opposed to have a cauldron of knowledge and a teaspoon of opinions.
Yeah.
So like I agree, and I think, you know, so I've changed and been doing some independent journalism. I'm trying very hard. I'm really pushing myself to say, look, I'm looking for truth, knowledge, and wisdom here. It's not about political agenda. It's not about narrative, and not about just the story of today. It's about these long-term big issues. Okay, we got, you know, cartels taking over country. You've got drugs in the United States and overdoses. You've got this big human wave of refugees and migrants. These are big issues that matter and will matter for years to come, not just the kind of latest thing that's happening and latest he said, she said, they said thing on the news. So I try and push and go, and it's like, and not about, you know, worrying about being brave about this, because you know as well with the current thing in the media that, you know, as a journalist, you know, all your colleagues are watching, you know, what, how come he said that and he's talking to that guy and that guy's a... So just like, be brave, stand up with this stuff. Now, I would say, you know, I don't know if some of you probably know, I'm a fan of Substack. I think Substack's a real mixed bag, yeah. A general diversity of opinion there. So I created a Substack, if I may. I mean, you know, please come along and check out and comment and check out all the pieces. But you can see that www.crashoutmedia.com. I have that, and I have some links to other things as well. I mean, within Substack, you can find people talking about different issues, I think kind of breaking out of the paradigm. I think there's a lot of independent journalists and recommend others in the kind of network I have there, journalists or academics who I think are good and doing good work on this stuff. I think it's about building trust with the audience and saying, this is me, this is what I think, then listening to what they say and coming back. I think there's also some great journalists stood out in the New York Times, great journalists at, you know, the BBC on certain stories. You can find them on certain issues that are good. You can find ones that are bad. So, yeah, I think, but I think I totally can sympathize with people. I think it's a very, I mean, obviously what you're doing there, I'm bringing around and bringing people together. I think, but I think there, you know, it is important to really still do the trade of journalism is important. It's still important to get out there and do the deep reporting, to get out there in the field and to be, you know, like to see the stuff with your own eyes, to see like out there, what, you know, if we're talking about the border, to be at the border and see what it looks like and see how the cartels are operating and moving there, to see the human traffickers, the human smugglers, to talk to them, to talk to everybody you can, and to try and bring some good information about this. And like you say, people are going to have their opinions and make up, you know, their opinions and about these issues.
Yeah, I'm all for people having their opinions. Oftentimes I worry that they're just parroting other people's opinions because it's more convenient, or they got their news from a meme, which oftentimes I do as well, because memes are fantastic and they crack me up sometimes. But we're more evolved than that as a species. I think the more that we can think deeply on things, and that starts with having a resource that people can go towards and actually educate themselves if they have the desire to do so. So, Johan, I really appreciate what it is that you're doing, and I hope that you're able to stay safe and continue on this path. And I will give you the closing words. What would you like to close it out with?
Yeah. Thanks. It's great to be here. No, like, I think this kind of media revolution we're talking about is a good thing. I think, you know, like there's breaking away, at least having a space breaking away from this kind of left, right, whatever that means these days. But just kind of having some truth, some knowledge, some discussion about these issues, if we want to try and move on and try and, you know, understand these real complex realities. But like, you know, one thing with this, you know, this violence that I've covered the last couple of decades, I've seen some real grim things, you know, stuff that I didn't expect to find myself covering. You know, I came out of this, originally it was exciting, exotic drug dealers, and I found myself covering things like 49 bodies that had been dumped on a road, who had their heads cut off, their hands cut off, their feet cut off, talking to the mother who's looking for her son who's being dragged away by guys with guns, and she doesn't know she's going to find him. And you know, this is a mother who's a school teacher whose son's just about starting college, you know, to study philosophy, and he's been dragged away by gunmen, and that is the kind of result of this. So that really kind of, when you see some of that bloodshed, you really see that, you think, wow, this is real crazy, and this stuff could spread, and we've got to think about this, we've got to find better ways, because otherwise for our children, for the next generation, for their children, you know, this could be even worse. Maybe we've gone through the kind of good years, and there could be some real bad years to come. But you know, human beings are resilient, and we can find better ways, we can find solutions to this. So we've got to keep cracking away and looking for better ways with this.
I totally agree. Johan, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you again for joining us for Change Agents, an Ironclad original. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and we're going to be back next week with an all new episode and a new guest.